How's it going? My name is John Steyert, and you're listening to Social Echoes from True Voice Media. Welcome into the world of social business, learning, and all things in between. This is episode 15. You can find more episodes on our website, socialechoespodcast.com. You can go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio and search Social Echoes. If you've enjoyed some of the past interviews or guests we've had on, we'd love to hear your feedback. Please leave a review, give us a rating, good, bad, or indifferent, just so that we have an idea of how you're liking the show and what other topics you'd like to hear us discuss. Don't forget, you can always tweet me at Social Echoes or at JW Steyert using the hashtag Social Echoes. Email me, John, J-O-N, at truevoicemedia.com. One of my favorite podcasters, Mitch Joel, who will be on the show in a few weeks, always likes to talk about being the dumbest person in the room. It's pretty easy to be the dumbest person in the room when, like myself, you're 25 years old and you're talking with some of the brightest minds in business in Philadelphia and in the rest of North America. So what Mitch means when he says that is he tries to soak up every bit of knowledge that he can every day, and I try and do the same thing in my own life and with this podcast. Today's guest makes you stop and think about what you're doing. He questions the motivations for what you're doing today. Why are you listening to this podcast? Hopefully it's because Social Echoes has brought you some great value. But these are the sorts of questions that come to mind when you begin to explore the work of Daniel Pink. Dan has written 5 best-selling books on the social science that fit right into the world of social business, just like Michael Brito talked about on episode 14. His latest book is titled To Sell as Human, touching on the human elements of sales and debunking the slimy salesman myths. Whether your job title involves sales or not, this book will have resonance with you. So without more time wasted on my own, it's a pleasure to introduce Daniel Pink. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So before we kind of get into the book a bit more, I wanted to kind of ask you about your own personal motivations for getting into writing these books on what some people would kind of call the soft sciences, the social sciences. You went to law school. I mean, that's kind of it's been talked about in your TED Talks. What kind of is your motivation that kind of allowed you to start writing these books and exploring these facts and information?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I sort of had a circuitous. I think I've had this experience when you ask people who are doing interesting things something, you say, yeah, that's really cool, and you say, how'd you get to be doing that? I think the really interesting people always have the same answer, which is, it's a long story. So it's a long story, but the gist of it is that I actually studied as an undergrad linguistics, which is a fascinating discipline. It's kind of the juncture of the hard sciences and social sciences. Really, really interesting field dealing with both biology and the social science and humanities. It's a great major. But instead of being an academic, I decided to go to law school because I was a middle-class kid from Central Ohio, so that's what you did. And ended up never wanting to be a lawyer, so instead, much to my amazement, I decided that I wanted to work in politics because I'd always been interested in politics. So I worked in politics for a while, doing a lot of economic policy, and eventually making my way to become a speechwriter in politics through, again, no planning of my own. But throughout that time, I'd always been writing on the side, quote unquote, on the side, writing articles for newspapers and magazines. And finally, it got to a point, this is a while ago now, 16 years ago, almost 16 years ago, that I said, I can't stand working in politics anymore. It's totally BS. I don't like it. I don't have control over what I'm doing. I've been writing on the side maybe for years and years and years. Maybe I should just be writing in the center rather than on the side. And so I went out trying to write on my own. And what I was most interested in was work. Why people work, what people do at work. Work is endlessly fascinating. And one of the things, we spend over half our waking hours at work. And so it becomes this incredible window into understanding who people are, what makes them tick, how they get along with each other, what are their aspirations. I mean, just an amazing, serious questions. And what I found as I got a little bit further along is that that writing and finding things anecdotally is good, it's useful, but I just felt that at some level it wasn't substantial enough. And so I got into, and as someone who had been a pretty hardcore social science guy in college, and even in law school as well, I said, well, you know, maybe I can give this a little bit more heft to it. And I started looking at the social science and I realized there's just an amazing rich trove of social science out there that actually makes some of these individual stories, these individual examples, come to give them some substance. And then I think the stories give the substance some life. And so I found that that's actually what is – that's the kind of stuff that I like to read. It helps what I learn from. And, you know, I think a cardinal rule of writing is you got to write books that you want to read, because if you don't want to read them, no one's going to want to read them.
Yeah, the book was great. And I was telling you that before we jumped on the broadcast. And the stories that you have in there are perfect for the lessons that you're trying to give out. So let's kind of get into the gist of what the book is about. And it's about sales, but it's also not about sales. But the biggest question that I want to start out with is, selling scares the bejesus out of people. I personally used to be scared of selling. It scared me out of my mind.
What scared you about it?
I think a lot of it has to do with if you didn't know the information backwards and forwards, and that's something else that we're going to get into, it, information asymmetry. People will look at you and they'll kind of be able to knock you down a little bit. And I am, and also another thing I want to talk about, introverts versus extroverts. And I'm kind of in the middle based upon your assessment on your website, which would make me an ambivert. I would get kind of flustered a little bit. And I can even feel it right now. Even though, like, it's just you and me talking, I feel a little bit, like, you know, because I'm trying to sell the information that I have, you know, that you've given to me, that I've researched on you, that I'm now trying to portray to my audience. It's just a strange thing, but kind of the question to be boiled down to is, why shouldn't people be afraid of selling or sales?
Yeah, I think you hit on something that's so important and so central to this book, this basket of ideas, which is that we do have this kind of visceral distaste for sales. It's a distaste in some ways because we think it's demeaning in a way. We think that the way to do it well is to be duplicitous, to be dishonest, to be manipulative. But I also think that it does scare people because it's very, very difficult. It forces many people out of their comfort zone. And as it's sort of implicit in what you're talking about, there's a lot of rejection. That is, you go out there and you're going to hear no, 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 no. And so I think that the way to get over this is many ways to get over this. On the first point, the idea that sales is slimy, sleazy, all about hoodwinkery. Not anymore, or much less so now. That view of sales, as you alluded to earlier, comes from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer, okay? So if the seller knows this much and the buyer knows this much, the seller has a huge advantage. And this is why we have the principle of buyer beware. And a lot of the reasons, a lot of our associations with sales as sleazy and manipulative and dishonest comes from our experience being down here, comes from our experience being at an information disadvantage and knowing that these slimy, slippery sellers can rip us off. But what's happened in the last few years is that information asymmetry that defined the sales relationship is becoming closer to information parity. And so, you know, I always use the example of cars because I think it's so vivid. 20 years ago, you go into a car dealer, the car dealer's going to know a lot more about cars than you will. A lot more about that make, a lot more about that model, all right? That's why we have the principle of buyer beware, all right? But that's not the world today. Today is closer to information parity. So now you go into a car dealer, you might have as much information as a car dealer. And so that's a world of information parity. That's a world of seller beware. And so I think the first thing is that you're dealing in a world where the low road is blocked off. So no one's suggesting when you sell to take the low road because it just doesn't work very well anymore. So that's one thing. The second thing on the rejection, the scariest part about the rejection is there are techniques that you can use to get better at dealing with rejection, and they're really grounded in the social science. They're really practical kinds of things that you can do to, you know, prepare yourself before an encounter, what you do during an encounter, how you explain failure and rejection after an encounter that people can learn to get better at. And then to your point about knowing the information, you got to know the information even more so now. That is, there's a premium, really a new premium on expertise. And so So at some level, I mean, you're sort of taking a more enlightened view of it, is that a lot of times people could go into sales thinking, I don't have to know that much about it. I just have to be a glad hander. I just have to be friendly. I have to be a schmoozer. And that doesn't work. Might have worked in the old days when buyers didn't have many choices, didn't have much information. Not a good idea today.
And you talk about now how everyone is in sales to some degree. To what extent do you think that social tools are used internally for collaboration and externally for marketing, communications, and customer service have intensified the need for everyone to understand sales?
Oh, to a very large extent, to answer your question, you know, succinctly, I think they've had, like, played a big role in that. I think they put, you know, if we take a step back, we look at what we do every day at work. A big portion of it is sales, even if we're not in sales. We're saying we're at an idea pitching. We're at a meeting pitching an idea. We are trying to. You and I are on the same. You're a colleague of mine. I'm saying, come on, John, work on my team, not this other team, because my project's more awesome than that project. I'm selling you on that idea. You could be my boss, and you could be saying to me, hey, Dan, I'm trying to sell you on the idea of doing different things in different ways. If you're my boss, I could be trying to sell you on the idea of, hey, John, we need a little bit more help on this thing, you know. And so we're doing it all the time. And what has happened is, as the social tools have put a booster rocket on it, so both internally and externally. Now, internally, I think what's so interesting, social media, even for something as sort of generation before that of email, there is much greater communication across levels, across functions and firms than ever before because of these tools. And so you're sort of in a much more, you're pitching, persuading, influencing to a much wider number of people internally, big time. I mean, what's so funny is that you think about the elevator pitch. The reason the elevator pitch came along is that you had to be ready if you encountered the big boss, you know, getting on the elevator, you could explain what you did in the 30 seconds that it took to get to your floor. But now, like, you know, you got open floor plan. Okay, the big boss is right over there. You got smaller operations. The big boss is only one of 10 people. Even if you're in a big corporation, you just go, you know, send an email to bigboss@acmewidgets.com. And, you know, you can reach him or her. So it's given internally even. And I think a lot of times we forget how much internal kind of selling persuasion there is. It's put a huge booster rocket on that. And then go out into the wider world, and anybody can blog, sell your ideas. Anybody can tweet, sell your ideas. Anybody can post something on Facebook, sell your idea. You know, and so I think they've put this. I think they've been just kind of a, you know, a booster rocket on it. That, you know, we used to have some of this going on at kind of a, you know, at one kind of velocity, and when these things come on and get attached to it, whoosh, suddenly it's, you know, at an, you know, a velocity that's order of a magnitude more swift.
So you talk about the elevator pitch, and then you have the evolution of the elevator pitch. And in the book, you have six different delineations of the evolution of that. One of them that I really want to talk about is the one word pitch. Yeah. And kind of how you boil that down into, you know, some of the greatest brands in the world. In the book, you talk about Apple. You talk about Google. MasterCard, and one of the ones I think of too is Disney Magic. How quickly do we have? I mean, there's so much noise in the world, as you were talking about. Brevity is like a diamond in the rough. It's valuable. It gets attention because it's shiny. How do brands and people arrive to these one-word messaging ideas?
Often slowly and deliberately, and by taking it seriously. So the one-word pitch is an idea. The genesis of it is Morris Saatchi, the great ad man in the UK. And so he has this notion of what he calls one-word equity, that basically today, for the reason, exactly the reasons you're saying, there's so much noise, there's so much distraction, there's so much hubbub out there that that people, particularly digital natives, they don't have a lot of bandwidth to give you. And so you have to push, again, your word, we have to push brevity to almost to its breaking point. And
that's your word. I took the brevity because of what you were talking.
Well, okay, so we can be each other's own hallelujah choruses here. So you push that brevity to its maximum, and basically the idea behind one word equity is that when people think of your company or you, they think of that word. When people think of that word, they think of you or your company. And Google is a good example of that. So, I mean, when you hear the word search, what company do you think of? Google. I mean, yeah. MasterCard is not is a sort of less intense version of when you think of a master, when you think of the word priceless, who do you think of? MasterCard, typically. And so I like this as a discipline because it forces people to get to the core. What are you really about? what are you really, truly about? And I think it's, I don't think that every single entity must have a one-word pitch, but I think that the exercise of thinking it through is really powerful because it says, who are we? What do we stand for? What are we about? And I just have no tolerance for people who say, that's too simplistic, that's dumbing it down. I don't think so. I think that it is. I think that it is putting discipline on this process, forcing you to make choices, forcing you to say what's important. What are you going to discard? You know, you're on a boat. You can only have one item. What are you going to toss overboard? And that really gives us a sense of who people are, who companies are.
And I mean, think of it this way: we're in a 140 character world. Even though you have, when you're writing a post on Facebook, people don't want to read any more than a couple of sentences. And I remember reading an article, I think it might have been on Mashable, one of the original stock ticker guys that was in the 80s, he only had about 80 characters. So he says, oh, when I'm on Twitter, it's the easiest thing in the world for me. So I think that thought process of trying to condense your thought processes into a really pearl of an idea or a message is just so powerful. And I was one of my favorite parts of the book.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think it's necessary today. Now, this doesn't mean that every form of communication has to be boiled down to one word or 140 characters, but it does mean that you have to be able to do that too, that it has to be in your repertoire. I mean, what we're doing here is in some ways luxurious. We're having this long conversation, freewheeling. If we were to put out a transcript and add up all the characters, there are going to be thousands, if not tens of thousands of characters there. Probably there'll be tens, depending on how long we talk, let's see. There'll be thousands and thousands of words. Thousands of words, maybe not 10,000s of words, but thousands of words. There'll probably be tens of thousands of characters. But, you know, at some level we have to think about what is the ultimate message? And the message here of this particular podcast could be, you know, thinking about your question about social, maybe the message is rocket boosters, which is even two words, you know? The idea that social media has provided a rocket booster on this already emerging trend of people having to sell all the time.
So how about for Daniel Pink? I mean, you're talking about rocket boosters and social media. How have you utilized social media to kind of not so much sell yourself, but you know, it's a form of non-sales selling because you
Absolutely.
Go and you speak all over the country, and it's not so much you're not telling people buy my stuff, but you being there is kind of then leading people down the path of, oh, well, Daniel said some really interesting things. I want to read more.
But think about, Twitter is a good example because I'm fairly active on Twitter. I haven't done much on Facebook at all. I mean, the only thing it's some level I use Facebook. I've spent more time on Google Hangout than on Facebook. But I do have Facebook tied to my Twitter account tied to my Facebook. So what do I like about Twitter? A number of different things that are helpful. Number one is that if I see something interesting, I can just share it with people. And so I'm just basically doing, I don't know, just there's no great advantage in my doing that, but people tend to like it. And I mean, there is an advantage ultimately of that people might pay attention to me and say, hey, this guy has something interesting to say. So when I share links or that sort of stuff, people might find it interesting. I find it very interesting, though, as a form of, we tend to think of Twitter, the social media, very much from the outbound side of it, but the speaking, in quotes, side of it. But I think the listening side of it is even more powerful. And so when I watch what's going on Twitter, or I see a lot of times I'll go out and do something, do an interview, go do a talk somewhere, and people will be tweeting it. And I'll look after it and say, ooh, wait a second. And I'll see the tweets. At Daniel Pink thinks he's much funnier than he really is. At Daniel Pink doesn't know how to pick a tie, you know. At Daniel Pink, this, that. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's very helpful feedback here. And when you hear what people are talking about out there, you get a really good sense of it. And you put some other, you know, on my tweet, I can't think what you call it. It's a column on my tweet deck where I can follow certain phrases and whatnot. And so, you know, if I see someone tweet about a book I wrote a while ago called A Whole New Mind, it's like, what are people saying about A Whole New Mind? What are people saying about a book I wrote called Johnny Bunko? I wrote a book called Drive, which you can't do it with because you get too much stuff. But, you know, a column for each of those things saying, The Adventures of Johnny Bunko, worst book I ever read. Okay, good. I'm a trending negative topic in Indonesia. Cool. You know, so So it's really, 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 really helpful for listening. It also gives me a sense of, when people sort of not necessarily direct message me, but people just sort of do an at Daniel Pink trying to tell me something. I get good, you know, I get really, really interesting, really, really good feedback. And so, you know, just it's like, I mean, it's hard to it's like having like both a like a broad, I mean, I'm sitting here in my garage, a converted garage. So right there, viewers can't see this, right there is my backyard. So it's sort of like having a giant satellite dish in my backyard, putting things out there. And then it's also like having like 10,000 extra pairs of ears. So how awesome, and it doesn't cost anything. I mean, how awesome is that? I got this giant satellite dish and 10,000 pairs of ears for free. That's a good deal. That's when you think about it that way. Now when I think about it, yeah. That's an a freaking good deal. Yeah.
So I want to really, really quickly, because we're getting to the end of our podcast, the new ABCs of selling. So it used to be, as you put on your blog the other day from Alec Baldwin's cameo in Blank Diary, Glenn Ross, always be closing. Instead, right. Now it's attunement, buoyancy, and clarity.
Right.
In the short version, how did you come upon these ABCs?
Well, I mean, I was looking, these ABCs describe the foundational qualities, the qualities that are necessary in moving people, sales and non-sales selling in a world of seller beware. Attunement is perspective taking, buoyancy is staying afloat in an ocean of rejection, and clarity is going from accessing information to curating it, going from solving existing problems to identifying problems people don't realize that they had. How did I come about it? Well, painstakingly. So what I did is I went into the research and in the interviews and said, okay, so what are the things that really matter? And I ended up with a giant list of stuff and ended up winnowing it down. Okay, this doesn't make very much sense. This makes more sense. And I just lucked out in a way. It's like I didn't have to force it into A, B, C. That it ended up being, it's like, whoa, wait a second. You know, that could be, I mean, attunement is really perspective taking. So I could have called it PBC, but that doesn't really do a lot for me. But you can, you know, call it perspective taking attunement, and it makes an ABC. Buoyancy I got as soon as I interviewed a fellow who's a sales 40-year veteran salesperson who said every day in sales you face an ocean of rejection. And I'm thinking that's a perfect metaphor. How do you stay afloat in that ocean of rejection? So you know, it really was just sort of pain. I started out with like a huge long list of things and then winnow until what I have is like really, you know, really, really solid. I started out the same way with the pitches. I had a sense that pitching was changing and I had probably had a list of 24 different ways to pitch. And then I realized, you know, 18 of them were really stupid. And so I ended up with 6. But for a long time, actually till pretty late in the book, I had 9 pitches. And I realized that 3 of them, which I'm not going to mention here, just really didn't pass the test. They were kind of lame, you know. They didn't have a lot of evidence behind them. They were sort of cheesy, and I got rid of those and focused on the 6. So it's a really just winnow, cast a wide net, go through stuff, be kind of relentless about what stays in and what stays out. Basically, what I look at it is that everything that's in the book, every sentence really, is essentially fighting for its life. Then when I look at that sentence or that particular idea, it's like you have to justify, not that I'm talking to inanimate objects this way, but I say you have to justify to me why you deserve to stay in here, all right? My presumption is that I'm going to cut you. So tell me why you should stay in.
So the last thing I want to lead off with is, we alluded to it earlier, the ambiverts. When I first met my boss, he pegged me as an introvert, not totally on the side of like being holed up as a hermit, but he pegged me on the side of being introverted. But at the same time, I know that I can be extremely extroverted, and my friends can tell you the same thing. So when I took your assessment, and you can do that by going to danielpink.com/assessment, I wasn't surprised when it said that I was an ambivert, which means that I'm in the center of both introverted and extroverted. In your book, the facts point to ambiverts being the best salespeople. So my question is it necessary for introverts and extroverts to be ambiverts in order for them to be successful at sales?
Not necessarily, because, I mean, it's not like, I mean, what this research from Adam Grant at Penn showed is that strong introverts weren't very good sellers. Strong extroverts weren't very good sellers. The people in the middle, the people who were a little bit of both, the ambiverts, a term that's been in the literature since the 1920s, those are the people who fared the best. That said, it doesn't mean if you're an ambivert, you're going to do better. It doesn't mean if you're an ambivert, you're going to be a good salesperson, because there are other things that go into it. Do you, do you work hard? Are you conscientious? Do you know your product or service inside and out? So there are other, so there are other kinds of things like that. So I think but I do think that it's good guidance for people who are very strongly introverted or very strongly extroverted to kind of do what they can to nudge a little bit to the center, recognizing that introversion, extroversion is a very stable personality characteristic. You can't just, like on a 1 to 7 scale of introversion and extroversion, 1 being extremely introverted, 7 being extremely extroverted. I test about a 2.5, 2.6. Okay, I'm much more introverted than extroverted. I'm not a super strong introvert, but I test more introverted than extrovert, no question, always have. So you're never going to turn me into like a glad-handing Mr. Smiley kind of guy, ever. I don't care what you do to me. That's not who I am. But what I can do is I can nudge a little bit more to the center. I can look at what extroverts do and say, well, that's kind of cool. It's like I never strike up conversations with strangers. And extroverts tend to always strike up conversations with strangers. And you can learn some cool stuff and have a good experience if you do that every once in a while. I'm always skittish about like going into a social setting and introducing myself to somebody I don't know. Extroverts have no problem. My extroverted friends do that like they're breathing. And it's like, okay, that's actually not bad. I can learn how to do that a little bit. And it's the same on the other side of it. The extroverted people can take a cue from me. I go into a big social setting, and I don't plunge right in. I go around the periphery, see what's going on, take a look at it. Hey, how's this laying out? And then I go in. And you know what? They can learn from that too, because they might be missing the most important thing there. So all of us can nudge a little bit to the center by looking at our counterparts on the other side and saying, and not saying, oh, they're not like me. This guy's too shy. He's a mouse. I don't know. I can't learn anything from him. And then the people on my side saying, looking at the other side, saying, oh, this guy's like total bullshit.
The FCC is going to come and get you now.
Yeah. He's a total BSer. He's like a glad hander. He's full of it. He's pompous, And if you have a little bit more empathy for the either side and learn from them, you can nudge a little bit more to the center.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about the ambiversion, I guess you could say ambiversion, if you can say extroversion and introversion, is that it gives me hope for kind of becoming a better salesperson and just selling myself better off. So,
yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for all your hard work behind the scenes, writing and putting together to Sell as Human. Where can people go to be social with you?
My website is www.danpink.com, danpink.com. On Twitter, I'm @DanielPink.
Well, great. Are you working on anything else, or are you kind of staying low for a little bit?
I'm working on selling this set of ideas. So I'll eventually work on something new, but for now, I'm working on this.
Good. I know there are some authors that I've spoken to that they can't sit still. They always have ideas burning, which I'm sure you have ideas burning and things, but they can't seem to settle themselves to just focus on the one project at a time. But I wish you the best of success continuing to sell.
Thank you,
everything. I encourage everybody to go and read the book, listen to it on audiobook if you need to. That's how I did it. That'll do it for this episode of Social Echoes. If you like the podcast, please subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and then leave us a review. That'd be great. Good, bad, or indifferent. We want to know how we can better serve you, the community of Philadelphia, with social media and social business. Always feel free to email me, John, J-O-N, @truevoicemedia.com. You can tweet me, @JWSteiert, @JWSteiert. And until next time, thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.